Tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Europe boosting its aid for Iraqi refugees, and the world mourns the passing of a comic genius. I'm Joe Palca, reporting from Washington. Europe is boosting its aid for thousands of Iraqis attempting to flee the onslaught of Islamic State militants in northern Iraq. Britain and France dropped food, water, and solar lamps on Mount Sinjar yesterday to help Yazidi refugees and other religious minorities trapped on the mountaintop. Britain says it's sending nearly $7 million in aid to northern Iraq and deployed tornado surveillance aircraft to get a better look at the situation on the ground. Germany, meanwhile, plans to send non-lethal equipment, vehicles, night vision gear, and bomb detectors to the region, while the European Union pledged $7 million in aid. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry regarding additional help for the country.
We are prepared to consider additional political, economic, and security options as Iraq starts to build a new government, and very much calculated to try to help stabilize the security situation, to expand economic development, and to strengthen the democratic institutions.
With the help of Kurdish forces in the region, more than 20,000 of the refugees managed to escape Sinjar in the past few days. But thousands more are still there, and water and food are in short supply. Ukraine says it will not allow the convoy of 280 trucks carrying humanitarian aid from Russia to enter the country. Ukrainian officials said Tuesday that the convoy would not be allowed in because it's not being coordinated by the International Committee of the Red Cross and could be a pretext for Russia to send troops into separatist-held territory. With more for VOA, here's Gabe Joslow.
Russia said Tuesday it is sending 280 truckloads of relief supplies to residents of eastern Ukraine caught in the conflict between Ukrainian armed forces and pro-Russian separatists. However, Ukrainian officials say the Russian trucks are not part of an agreement with the International Committee of the Red Cross to deliver aid to the region. Ukrainian Deputy Foreign Minister Danilo Lukivsky told reporters that Russia can improve the situation in the east by stopping its support of rebel groups.
Stop the aggression. Stop the Russian terrorists. Stop the shelling. Stop your cynical propaganda. And there will be no need for any humanitarian aid.
Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kyiv.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. The World Health Organization says it is ethical to give Ebola patients unproven drugs to try to fight the worst ever outbreak of the disease raging in West Africa. The UN agency said Tuesday that the use of such drugs must be done with informed consent. The WHO hosted a debate on the topic on Monday. The same day, Liberian officials said they expect to soon receive an experimental drug from a U.S. company to treat two doctors who've become infected with Ebola. The drug called ZMapp has not been tested for safety in humans. Israeli negotiators say there's been no progress during Egyptian brokered talks with Hamas over how to end fighting in the Gaza Strip. The comments made by a senior Israeli official came on Tuesday, the second day of a 72-hour ceasefire that for now appears to be holding. Negotiators from Israel and Hamas have been holding indirect talks in Cairo aimed at coming up with a more permanent end to the violence. The gap between the two sides remains wide, but both Palestinian and Israeli officials say they hope to make progress during an intense session later on Tuesday. Human Rights Watch says Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi should be investigated for possible human rights violations in connection with the killing of hundreds of protesters last year in Cairo. In a new report Tuesday, the group outlines the conclusions of a year-long investigation into 6 weeks of violent crackdowns on protesters who were rallying against the ouster of former leader Mohamed Morsi. Tributes are pouring in for American actor comedian Robin Williams, who was found dead of an apparent suicide Monday at his California home. He was 63. A statement from his publicist said he'd been battling depression. Williams' longtime struggle with drugs and alcohol was well known. Just last month, he admitted himself into a rehabilitation facility to help maintain his sobriety. Paul Rodriguez is a comedian who first worked with Mr. Williams at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles in 1982.
I'm not the only one, man. Everybody in America tonight, I'm sure, felt like, wow, you know, you got punched in the stomach.
U.S. President Obama praised Williams as a one-of-a-kind performer who touched every element of the human spirit. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization has given a green light for the use of unproven drugs to fight the deadly Ebola outbreak in four West African countries. A panel of specialists agreed it is ethical to offer these treatments to try to curb the Ebola epidemic, which is the largest ever seen.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. Details next. Also in the news, Somalia's semi-autonomous Puntland region has cut all ties with the central government over a plan to form a new federal state in the center of the country. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization has released new figures on the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It now says there have been 1,848 cases and 1,013 deaths as of August 9th. The outbreak has claimed its first European victim. A Spanish priest died today at a Madrid hospital 5 days after being evacuated from Liberia. Father Miguel Perez, who was 75, had been treated with an experimental serum. He had contracted Ebola while working at St. Joseph Hospital in Monrovia. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has given a green light for the use of unproven drugs to fight the deadly Ebola outbreak in four West African countries. A panel of specialists agreed it is ethical to offer these treatments to try to curb the Ebola epidemic, which is the largest and most severe ever seen. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
There have been a number of Ebola outbreaks in Eastern and Central Africa over the past 40 years. The World Health Organization was able to stop those outbreaks by identifying and isolating all cases of the disease, tracing those who have come in contact with infected individuals, and providing protective covering to healthcare workers. But officials from the UN Health Agency acknowledge what has worked in the past is not working now. They say the outbreak in four West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, continues to spread and appears to be unstoppable. Therefore, WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says the panel of experts who convened Monday unanimously agreed that it is ethical to offer unproven medicines as potential treatments.
The magnitude and the spread of the outbreak makes it that we don't have enough people to use and to rely only, if I may say, on what has traditionally worked if we want to stop the outbreak as quickly as possible. So this is why, in these particular circumstances, the ethicists have felt that it was ethical to propose these treatments and this vaccine, although they have not been registered yet.
West African health authorities report that more than 1,800 people have come down with Ebola and more than 1,000 have died. There is no cure for this disease, which can kill up to 90% of its victims and is spread through direct contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an infected person. Researchers have found some potential treatments and vaccines that could help bring Ebola under control. But while a handful of these drugs have shown positive results in monkeys, they have not been clinically tested in humans to see whether they are safe and effective. The health of two American aid workers who got infected with Ebola in Liberia has improved since they were treated with an experimental drug known as ZMapp. This has raised hopes of other successful treatments by using this and other unproven drugs. While the WHO has given the go-ahead for the use of untested treatments and vaccines, Dr. Kini says certain ethical criteria must guide their use. These include transparency of care, informed consent, freedom of choice, confidentiality, and community involvement.
The panel also emphasized that because we know so little about safety and efficacy in humans, whenever these treatments are provided, for what we call compassionate use, which means as defined as access to an unapproved drug outside of a clinical trial, then there is a moral obligation to collect and share all data generated.
The World Health Organization says it will push for the speedy start of clinical trials for Ebola drugs that look promising. It notes that trials for two vaccine candidates might begin by the end of September. Were this to happen, it says information regarding their safety could be available by the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. And Nancy Cass is a professor of bioethics and public health at Johns Hopkins University and the Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. Cass raises questions about how the WHO and health ministries of the four affected countries will administer experimental drugs as they become available.
Drugs, obviously, usually need to go through a rigorous three-step process for both safety and effectiveness before they can ever be given to human beings. None of these Ebola drugs have gone through any kind of human testing. And I think they need to figure out whether it is appropriate to give it to even a few people at a time to see what the effects are, a few people with Ebola to see what the effects are, or whether at very least they need to wait until some safety trials have been done to make sure that the drug is at very least not harmful.
Health ministries seeking access to experimental drugs for patients face two critical questions. Will patients experience side effects? And even if the drugs don't harm the patients, will the drugs do any good?
There's a whole other kind of question about whether the drug is effective. Giving people an ineffective drug can sometimes also be harmful because it creates distrust or it makes public health people think that they have a solution when they don't. But the biggest risk is a safety risk.
Cass says safety tests should be performed on volunteers who do not have the disease so that doctors can isolate effects due to the drug.
It depends how long they want to wait to see what kinds of bad effects there are. Safety studies done properly also go gradually. You probably wouldn't give five people the drug at the same time in case there is a very serious toxic effect in humans. The best way to do it ethically is to give the drug to humans one at a time and at least wait a couple days so that in case person number one has this really horrible and unexpected reaction, you haven't given it to five people. To do a safety study well would take about a month.
Nancy Cass is a professor of bioethics and public health at Johns Hopkins University and the Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. The Ebola virus scare has gripped Cameroon following allegations that imported cases from neighboring Nigeria were diagnosed in the West African nation. Cameroon's Minister of Health has refuted the allegations. The World Health Organization says at least 10 cases of Ebola have been confirmed in Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Rumors that cases of the deadly Ebola virus had been detected at the government's referral hospital in Douala, Cameroon, spread like wildfire. 17-year-old student Marcel Frou told VOA that he was informed by the media of two Nigerians detected with the virus at the Douala airport and taken to the referral hospital.
J'ai écouté le journal de 20 heures à la télévision et on a annoncé qu'il y avait Ebola au Cameroun.
He says during the local television news, he received the information that there were already cases of Ebola carried by Nigerians into Cameroon. Nigerians throng into Cameroon on a daily basis for business, vacation, and fear of the militant group Boko Haram. Some clergy and traditional rulers took the message to their people, advising them to report other suspected cases. But Minister of Health Andre Mamafuda says the information about Nigerian Ebola victims in Cameroon was wrong.
With regard to our country, Cameroon, no suspected case has been reported till date. In preparation for a possible emergence of this disease, surveillance is strengthened in all the health districts on the borders, particularly at the level of health posts, airport, and seaports.
Mama Fuda said since the World Health Organization declared Ebola an international public health emergency, they have been working with Nigeria to halt the spread of the disease.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has provided us with two Ebola kits comprising 100 protective clothing for medical staff.
24-year-old University of Yaoundé student Enanga Mercy says the Minister of Health's message at least sounded reassuring.
I felt very relieved because considering what I saw on the internet on how the disease eats up people, it's really scary and very, very demoralizing. So when I got the news, I was really happy. And besides, the government cannot lie to us because they will have to tell us if the disease is in the country so that we'll take measures to protect ourselves from it.
Cameroon has been explaining to its residents that there is no cure and no vaccine for Ebola, and it has a high fatality rate. Dr. Etu Nimbala of the country's vaccination program told VOA in a telephone interview that Cameroon as a forest zone is prone to the disease and urged people to change some of their habits. He says Cameroon has lots of chimpanzees, monkeys and bats which they eat, and it is possible for the virus to spread that way, and adds that it is now forbidden to bring home an animal discovered dead in the forest. Sam Lingam, who eats bush meat, says it will be difficult for them to stop eating the meat.
Our parents, our forefathers ate the bush meat and did not die. I don't know why the government should be forbidding people from eating it. Anyway, as far as I'm concerned, I'll continue eating it, just making sure that the thing is well cooked.
The UN reports that unlike previous outbreaks of the Ebola virus, which had occurred in isolated areas, the West African epidemic erupted in areas with more traffic, trade and freedom of movement, making it easier to spread the disease. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Somalia's semi-autonomous Puntland region has cut all ties with the central government over a plan to form a new federal state in the center of the country. Puntland says the government wants to give parts of its territory to the new state. Analysts warn the latest bickering could set back efforts to bring peace to long-troubled Somalia. VOA's Mohamed Yusuf has the story.
Late last month, the Somali federal government and representatives from the central regions signed a document which say the leaders of the Galgaduud and Modug regions will work together in formation of a new administration. In a statement, the UN special representatives of the Secretary General for Somalia, Nicholas Kay, welcomed the move but warned of the challenges that await the leaders. Kay urged the leaders to solve any differences through dialogue and negotiations involving all clan leaders, women and civil society groups. Days later, Puntland cut all ties with the Mogadishu government over the formation of the new state. Somalia's constitution allows two or more regions to form a federal state. Galgaduud sits entirely in Somali government territory, but the Modug region is split into two, with one side being controlled by Puntland and the other by local authorities affiliated with the Somali government. Mohamed Ali Hashi, a politician from Puntland, says Modug was split into two because of deadly tribal conflict 20 years ago, and that recombining the regions would not be easy.
So if you want to combine that two, there is a lot of work to be done before you take that decision. Local people who are inhabitants in the area has to be consulted. The regional government of Puntland has to be consulted. If they agree, no problem. But if they don't agree, you cannot force them. So I think that was a mistake.
Somali media reports say some clans and local groups are also opposed to the deal signed in Mogadishu last month. Ali Hashi Mohamed Sahal, a central Somali politician who supports creation of a new federal state, says the people and leaders of the two regions should decide what kind of administration they want. All parties should be given and supported in the reconciliation efforts, and after that, they themselves should agree and decide on how they are going to form their state. If Mudug wants to be part of Garowe and Bosaso, or Mudug wants to join Galgudur and Hiran regions, they should do it without fighting among themselves. Abdirahman Mohammed, the head of a political consulting firm in Mogadishu, says a push to create the new state will be a test for the central government and the provisional federal constitution.
We will have regions that are basically inhabited by clans that come from different backgrounds. So different clans would be, in this case, if this goes through, this will create a precedence whereby regions will start to affiliate themselves with their clans, not according to the boundaries or regions that are stipulated in the constitution.
Despite the endless bickering among politicians, the United Nations and international community have insisted the process of federalism is necessary to build a stable and peaceful Somalia. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
21 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Today is World Elephant Day. It is estimated there are 500,000 elephants remaining in Africa. That's down from 1.2 million in the 1980s as poaching continues to take its toll. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
African Wildlife Foundation's Beatrice Karanja says World Elephant Day is an attempt to save an iconic animal.
What we hope to accomplish is to raise awareness to the plight of the elephants in Africa and the rate at which we're losing them, which is quite phenomenal. Africa lost 35,000 elephants last year, and it is predicted that if we continue on the trajectory that we are on now, we will see no elephants in the wild by 2025.
Speaking from Nairobi, Karanja says raising awareness about the plight of elephants begins at home.
Even here in Kenya, when you talk to general public, they are not aware of the rate at which we are losing them and the rate at which they could be extinct. So we are appealing to Kenyan brothers and sisters and our African brothers and sisters to take more of a cognizant role in calling for drastic changes in policy and legislative that can assure that we don't lose our iconic species.
Poaching is fueled by the demand for ivory, primarily in Asia. It's used in traditional medicine and as a status symbol.
Poaching has become almost militarized in that the poachers are using high-caliber weapons, sophisticated tools for tracking, whether it's GPSs or night vision goggles, etc. So it's a challenge when you've got a ranger who doesn't have that same equipment to fight against the poachers. We need more boots on the ground, and we need stronger legislative policies and laws.
Karanja says the Elephant Awareness Campaign also needs the will and commitment of African governments. Anti-poaching efforts do work. For example, foot and aerial patrols have reduced poaching by 50% in the Lower Zambezi National Park in Zambia. About 2,200 elephants live in the park. And thanks to anti-poaching efforts, the elephant population is reported on the rise in southern Kenya's Amboseli ecosystem. President Obama recently issued an executive order to launch a $10 million anti-poaching initiative. A task force will allocate the money to African countries and help develop a U.S. strategy against wildlife trafficking. Recently, two U.S. states, New York and New Jersey, passed laws banning the sale and purchase of ivory products. On August 9th, at Brookhouse School in Karen, Kenya, a celebration was held in honor of the African elephant. Karanja says it's important to get children involved in efforts to save the animal.
We do want to speak to them because we will be handing the baton of guardianship of the wildlands and of the wildlife to them. So it is important that they get involved early enough and they understand what the issues are.
While August 12th is World Elephant Day, conservationists are also raising awareness about the rhino. In South Africa, home to most of Africa's rhinos, more than 1,000 were killed last year. South Africa plans to evacuate hundreds of rhinos from the Kruger National Park to safer locations. The rhinos have been targets of poachers even within the park's boundaries. Officials say as many as 500 rhinos could be relocated to other parks and communal areas. Neighboring countries may also serve as safe havens. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Up to 245,000 Zimbabweans living in South Africa who were granted four-year amnesty permits that are set to expire at the end of this year have been given a three-year lifeline by the South African government. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, this comes as a big relief to these Zimbabweans who feared the loss of their permits would mean the loss of their jobs and returning to a life of poverty in their homeland.
In 2010, South Africa granted four-year residence permits to nearly a quarter million Zimbabweans who had entered the country illegally. However, many of the Zimbabweans who ran away from political and economic turmoil in their homeland have been living in fear as their permits were due to expire by the end of this year. But the announcement by the South African government on Tuesday brought relief to these Zimbabweans. Minister of Home Affairs Malusi Gigaba said that when the 2010 permits, known as DZP, expire at the end of this year, a new three-year Zimbabwean Special Dispensation Permit, ZSP, will kick in.
DZP permit holders who wish to remain in South Africa after the expiry of their permits can reapply for the ZSP. The ZSP will allow permit holders to live, work, conduct business, and study in South Africa until 31 December 2017.
However, the offer comes with conditions attached. Only holders of DZP will be allowed to apply for the ZSP permits. Applicants will be required to provide a valid passport, proof of employment, study, business ownership, and a clean criminal record. Applicants have been given 3 months to submit their application starting October 1. Applications will be accepted at newly opened visa centers throughout the country. The minister added that the ZSP will be the last special permits given to the Zimbabweans.
ZSP permit holders who wish to stay in South Africa after the expiry of the ZSP must return to Zimbabwe to apply for mainstream visas and permits under the Immigration Act. This means we will not be announcing in 2017 any new special permit.
The news of the new special permits has brought joy to the entire Zimbabwean community in South Africa. Solomon Chikoero, chairman of a Zimbabwean diaspora group, says Zimbabweans could not have gotten a better deal than this.
At least they have a breathing space for the next 3 years to put their papers in place, because there is also a leeway to move from the ZPC, because it's a special permit, to a proper permit which can allow you to apply either for certification or permanent resident thereafter.
An estimated 1.5 million Zimbabweans are believed to be living in South Africa as a result of economic and political turmoil in their homeland in the past 2 decades. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The World Health Organization says it is ethical to give Ebola patients unproven drugs to try to fight the worst ever outbreak of the disease raging in West Africa. And Somalia's semi-autonomous Puntland region has cut all ties with the central government over a plan to form a new federal state in the center of the country. Coming up, music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, we focus on a successful young village chief in Malawi. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports, with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you'll be kicking off with African football.
Yehias, joining us once again on The Voice of America from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, with qualifying matches scheduled for next month in the Africa Cup of Nations tournament, the Ebola outbreak remains a cause for concern in how it will affect those qualifiers.
Voice of America!
Can you give our Voice of America listeners an update?
Yes, Sonny. Unfortunately, just as I predicted, problems increasing as far as the Ebola virus crisis is concerned. And Togo, who are in the same group as Guinea, one of the affected countries, they have said they're not going to play in Guinea. And I think, Sonny, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm expecting more to come. Just to fill our listeners in, there are three groups that have countries that have been affected by the Ebola virus and where there have been a lot of deaths. In fact, as I speak to you, the figure of casualties is now hovering around the 1,000 mark. And it would be a brave person who would predict that that figure is not going to grow. And on behalf, I think, of the sunny side of sport, we wish all those health workers in Guinea, in Sierra Leone, in Nigeria, and in Liberia all the very best. This, Sunny, is bad, bad news for Africa. But returning to the Cup of Nations, Togo are due to start their campaign in Guinea, and the other matches that are going to have an immediate effect are Sierra Leone are due to travel to Ivory Coast, and Rwanda are due to travel to Nigeria. Now, I foresee, Sunny, three problems. The first one is that countries due to visit these three West African nations will not want to do so. In fact, they may well be advised by their governments not to travel. The second problem is going to be when it comes to Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria traveling, and their first matches in the groups will be Guinea going to Uganda, Sierra Leone going to Ivory Coast, and Nigeria coming to my place, South Africa. And again, the governments will say, we cannot admit these players in. The risk is too great. And this has happened once already, Sonny. The Seychelles would not allow the Sierra Leone team to travel to that island in the Indian Ocean, and the Seychelles had to forfeit the tie. Now, one way out of a situation like this is to play in neutral venues. You could, for example, say to Guinea and Togo, right, both matches will be played at a neutral venue in terms of fairness. But I cannot imagine any country with this Ebola virus situation permitting countries like Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Nigeria to come to their neutral country to play their matches. So whatever way you look at it, Sonny, it's really a very serious situation. And I trust those top officials of the Confederation of African Football in Cairo are working overtime to come up with some sort of a solution. Every time I phone CAF, they just tell me that they're monitoring the situation well. We need a little bit more now, with less than a month ago, than just monitoring. I think we need some action. But the Togolese, they are the first to take a concrete move. Their football association have said that because of Ebola, they do not want their national team to go into harm's way to travel to Guinea. Very worrying situation.
David, let's turn now to African club football. Action recently in the CAF Champions League. How about the results?
The results, funny, in Group A, Zamalek of Egypt 0, Vita of DR Congo 1, and TP Mazembe of DR Congo 3, El Hilal of Sudan 1. Now, Zambia and Vita have got 10 points each, and Zamalek and Hilal have got 4 points each. And with just one round to go, that means Zamalek and Hilal cannot possibly catch up on the top two. So a very big congratulations to the Democratic Republic of Congo. For the first time ever, Sonny, they've got two of their clubs through to the semifinals. And all that awaits us now is to know who will finish first. And as luck would have it, in the final round of matches on August 22, 23, and 24, Vita will host Mazembe in Kinshasa. And whoever wins that match will finish first. If it's a draw, Mazembe will finish on top under the head-to-head rule. The Vita winner came from Setamu. He's a Ugandan who celebrates his 20th birthday this week. And he scored after 56 minutes. A good away win that for Vita over a Zamalek team that really haven't lived up to expectations, Sonny. They started reasonably well. But in their last two games at home to Mazembe, 0-0 draw, and then Vita, a 0-1 defeat. So they only took 1 point out of a possible six. Hilal, unfortunately, equally disappointed and well beaten by Mazembe. Mazembe, in fact, were 3 goals ahead before El Tayeb scored a late goal for Hilal. And it's interesting to note the Mazembe scorers, because they are very much the what I call the United Nations team of Africa. The first goal came from Kalaba. He's a Zambian. The second goal came from Ashanti. He's a Ghanaian. And the third goal came from Traore, and he's a Malian. And just to answer some of our inquisitive listeners, yes, there are a couple of Congolese in the team as well, but not too many. Switching then, Sonny, to Group B, Anton Satif of Algeria 2, Esperance of Tunisia 2, and Al Hilal Benghazi of Libya 0, CS Sfaxien of Tunisia 1. And here, too, we now know the qualifiers for the semifinals. The table looks as follows. Sfaxien 10 points, Setif 9, surprise, surprise, Esperance only 4 points, and Benghazi 4 points. So Esperance and Benghazi are eliminated, but they will play each other in the final round to decide who finishes third. And as luck would have it again, just as in the other group, the top two teams meet in the final round. It'll be Sfaxien at home to Setif. Sfaxien need a draw to finish first, and Setif must win that match. A real thriller, the match between Setif and Esperance. Now, Esperance had to win to have any chance of survival, to have any hope of going through to the semifinals. And Akaichi scored after just 7 minutes to give the Tunisian blood and gold the lead. However, the Setif Black Eagles hit back with Janitz equalizing after 27 minutes from the penalty spot and putting his side ahead early in the second half. Akaichi scored again after 72 minutes, but Esperance needed that victory. They needed another goal. It would not come. And so the title favorites are out at the group stage. Sfaxien, under the leadership now of the well-known Frenchman Philippe Troussier, who is known in Africa as the White Witch Doctor, they scored their second victory in the space of 2 weeks, a goal from Sassi midway through the second half. So once again, Sonny, the qualifiers for the semifinals are Mazembe and Vita from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sfaxien of Tunisia, and Setif of Algeria. But in both groups, we still don't know who will finish first. And interestingly, we could end up with a Champions League final between Sfaxien and Mazembe. And they are exactly the same two teams who played last year in the final of the Confederation Cup.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. We'll be right back. Now let's go to Marrakesh, Morocco, where it's the third day of competition at the African Championships in Athletics. Highlighting Monday's action, an Ivorian sprinter set a national record in the men's 100-meter dash, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Winfred Kofi Hua improved Ivory Coast's 100-meter national record when he won the event in 10.05 seconds. Nigerians Mark Jelks and Edward Monzavu were second and third, respectively. Nigerian Blessing Okagbare reclaimed the women's 100-meter crown she first won 4 years ago. What's more, she improved her championship record with a winning time of 11 seconds. She was followed across the finish line by Ivory Coast's Muriel Ahore and Marie-Josée Talou. South African Rikanet Steenkamp and Ivory Coast's Rosvita Okou were credited with an identical time of 13.26 seconds in women's 100-meter hurdles. Steenkamp was declared winner, while Nigerian Nicole Denby bagged the bronze medal. Earlier on, Burkina Faso's Letitia Bambara won the women's hammer throw with a 65.44 meter effort. Senegal's defending champion Ami Sey was second, while Tunisia and Sarah Ben Saad placed third.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled Kenyan Javelin Thrower Julius Yego. Julius is defending his African title this week in Marrakesh. And you might say Julius has taken a high-tech approach to becoming African and Commonwealth champion in the javelin. To improve his technique, Julius studied YouTube videos of athletes like Czech great Jan Železný, the three-time Olympic champion and world record holder in the javelin. And clearly, Julius learned a lot from those YouTube videos. If you base it on his recent performances, his distance in the javelin has improved steadily over the past 5 years. And last year at the World Championships in Moscow, Julius Yego set a personal and Kenyan national record of 85.40 meters. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up in our feature segment, we focus on a successful young village chief in Malawi. And next, we look into the global fight against malaria. But first, some music. Here is Rwanda's Kamichi with Biakiti Say.
Bridge record.
Wanga mazimwe. Abantu bahabona. Abashinja kuguca inyuma. Attention, petits, ici affaire des adolescents. La machine est afrobeat, piano muramus.
Sirwa si hagara yo mudabo
Rwanda's Kamichi with Biakiti Say. In Malawi, a young village headman is proving wrong those who doubted his capability to rule Makata village. Residents did not expect a member of a religious sect that allows smoking of marijuana or cannabis to competently head the village. 5 years after he became chief, Somanji Makata is called the best chief to ever govern in semi-urban Makata. Lamik Masina had an audience with the urban traditional chief who wears his hair in dreadlocks.
It would be easy to mistake a village headman Somanji Makata for a roots reggae artist in the Ndiland Township, a densely populated suburb area in Malawi's commercial capital, Blantyre. Makata wears with pride dreadlocks, a carefree attitude, humility, and a love for fancy smart casual clothing. Tall and dark in complexion, the group of village headman is a staunch member of the Rastafarian sect, whose congregation bans cannabis as a religious sacrifice and smoke it as well. In Malawi, people who smoke cannabis are considered to be of unsound mind and potential troublemakers, thanks to health campaigns linking cannabis to mental illness. Makata, who took the chieftaincy after the death of his father, Evans Makata, agrees his religious affiliation raised eyebrows in his village when he was chosen as a chief until his family cleared his good image.
What our families told the people that everything starts in Ndiland, and in Ndiland, especially the Makata family, we shall demonstrate that Rastafarians are peacemakers. And it was a time when this village was highly in conflict. But when I come in, I united all these people. I can claim that I have demonstrated that people can trust a Rastaman.
Joseph Sola is the resident of Mlanga village, which is under Makata. He says as villagers, they are happy to live under him, saying this is contrary to what they were expecting because they thought that he will be taking advantage of chieftaincy to abuse people and that he will be pompous. But he says what they see now is different. He says he's proving to be one of the best chiefs they have ever had in the village. Makata, who is from the Yao ethnic group, says during his reign he has managed to maintain peace and unity to the semi-urban village, which comprises people of mixed ethnic groups. The chief's record book shows that Makata has over 40,000 registered villagers, making it one of the most populous villages in or around Blantyre. But the 37-year-old chief concedes that he does not do the job single-handedly. He says under him is a chief's council made up of 65 village elders who act as advisory board on crucial issues arising in the village. They also complement his core responsibilities of handling disputes among residents and promoting peace. Situated within the city of Blantyre, Makata says he enjoys a good working relationship with the city assembly officials.
We work hand in hand with the city assembly. It's only that sometimes maybe the plans which we can have might differ with the city assembly's plans. But in general, I can say the working relationship has very much improved because even the chief executive himself, he has been on the forefront facilitating the developmental meetings between the chiefs and the city assembly.
The son of the former politician, Makata, says he would not allow his political affiliation to interfere with his chieftaincy.
We are the parents to every political party, so I can claim that even the just ended tripartite elections, in my village nobody complained that the chiefs under me were favoring a certain political party. No, we prayed our rightful role as stakeholders so that the elections can be free and fair and credible.
Makata says the most challenging part of the job is when someone forces him to lose his temper. This can happen when someone who knows him, perhaps a childhood friend, commits a crime but fails to come to the chief's court to be disciplined.
Imagine you are summoning somebody just because maybe he knows you from birth, you grew up together, he's trying to test your powers. I cannot come to Limbani. And you be thinking, this is my friend, we are together on the same desk, what? Can I use my powers? So when it's come to judgmental issues, it doesn't look to anybody's face. There is no favor or anything.
He, however, says there are exciting moments as well.
Imagine with my age, elderly people coming to you seeking your advice. And the other thing is, every marriage which comes in, people have to come to you. Every child which is born, people have to come to you. Every funeral have to come to you. So it's a thing which, when you are by yourself sometimes, you ask the Most High that, why me?
Makata says he's planning to share authority with other 10 village headmen, family members who will serve under him. This will be an addition to 3 small chiefs who currently owe allegiance to him. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Planta.
Anti-malarial drugs based on a substance called ordomycinine have led the global fight against malaria for a long time. But a new study in the New England Journal of Medicine says the medicines are losing their potency along the Thai and Cambodian borders and in some other Asian countries. The good news is the drugs still work well in Africa for now. VOA Steve Barragona talks to authors of the research who say new and better drugs are not far away.
From Vietnam to Burma, the leading drug against malaria is losing potency, according to a new study in the New England Journal of Medicine. Artemisinin-based drugs have helped public health workers make dramatic gains against malaria worldwide. So the rise of resistance is very worrying, says Dr. Chris Plow at the University of Maryland School of Medicine.
There's nothing on the shelf that's ready to replace those. So if we lose this class of drugs, it's really going to be a global health catastrophe.
He and his colleagues studied resistance rates in 7 Asian and 3 African countries. The worst problems were along the Thailand-Cambodia border. But they found significant resistance from southern Vietnam to central Burma. That's bad news, says Columbia University microbiologist David Fiddock, who is not involved in the research.
So what this paper shows is that it's moved beyond the original confine, which was in Western Cambodia, and has now spread across Southeast Asia. So that speaks to the possibility that, you know, from there it can jump into Africa, which is the big concern ultimately.
That's what happened with resistance to previous malaria drugs, and it cost countless lives. In fact, Plow says, this part of the world has proved to be a drug-resistant malaria hotspot.
Yeah, it's happened again and again, at least with 4 different anti-malarial drugs that we know of now, where resistant parasites popped up first along the border between Thailand and Cambodia.
It's not clear why. Scientists are trying to figure that out. The good news is Plow's group did not find resistance in Africa yet. And he says the drugs take longer to work, but they still do. For now,
we don't have very much time with the artemisinins based on the rate at which resistance appears to be emerging and spreading.
In another study in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, a new drug quickly rid 21 patients of malaria parasites. It's called spiroindolone, and it's made by the pharmaceutical company Novartis. It's on track to be the first to take over when the artemisinin drugs fail. But Plow is cautious.
Because it's very early days, this was a very small study, but the initial news is pretty good.
Fiddock notes, however, that the drug has a known weakness.
That target can mutate fairly readily. So we know that it's already, to some degree, susceptible to resistance.
Spironolactone would be combined with at least one other drug to slow down resistance. And Fiddock notes there are other drugs racing to be ready for the day when artemisinin fails. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Rashad Smith, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. The Earth's population is expected to grow from 7 to more than 9 billion people by 2050. And because extreme conditions such as hotter temperatures, longer droughts, and unpredictable rainfall patterns are increasing stress on food production, producing sufficient food for all will become more challenging. We cannot prevent extreme weather, but we can better prepare for the problems it may cause. The number of weather-related disasters has tripled in the last 30 years. While low-income countries suffered through only 9% of them, they represented 48% of all fatalities. That is why the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is partnering with the Rockefeller Foundation to form the Global Resilience Partnership, a public-private initiative to build local resilience to chronic shocks and stresses. By better aligning humanitarian and development planning, connecting the private sector with civil society and government, and crowdsourcing innovations and solutions, the Resilience Partnership will enable communities to prepare for, withstand, and emerge from shocks and stresses in a way that reduces chronic vulnerability and keeps them on the pathway to development. The Global Resilience Partnership will focus on the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, and Southeast Asia, areas particularly susceptible to chronic stresses and extreme shocks. In the Horn of Africa and the Sahel, some 23 million people suffered from hunger due to drought in 2011 and 2012. Conversely, in South and Southeast Asia, over 400 million people are expected to be affected by flooding within the next decade. Disasters and shocks pose an unparalleled threat to the world's most vulnerable communities and hamstring global humanitarian response, said USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah. This new bold partnership will help the global community pivot from being reactive in the wake of disaster to driving evidence-based investments that enable cities, communities, and households to better manage and adapt to inevitable shocks. USAID is proud to partner with the Rockefeller Foundation in advancing this new model, harnessing public-private partnerships and empowering country leadership to end extreme poverty. That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
The Voice of America, VOA.